Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. We know that getting some education beyond high school can help individuals and communities thrive. So why do we make it so hard for so many people to access that additional education? Why is higher education so expensive, with student loan debt now at an all-time high of over $1.5 trillion? Will we get free college nationally under President Biden? Our guest today is an expert in free college. Michelle Miller Adams is a senior researcher at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research and a professor of political science at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. She just published a great book, The Path to Free College, in Pursuit of Access, Equity, and Prosperity. Michelle has been influential in helping shape free college programs in communities and states around the country, as well as helping shape the thinking about free college in the Biden campaign and administration. Michelle Miller Adams, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. It's so nice to be here.
I'm so excited about your book because I'm a huge fan of education, you know, at every level, as much as you can get, whoever you are. It's a good thing for you as an individual, and it's good for society. But I'd like to hear you say, you know, you're really kind of dedicating your life to this. Why do you think some education after high school is important?
I'm very interested in exactly what you just identified, these policies that are good for individuals, but also good for the society and the economy. And you're absolutely right to say that education, more of it for everyone who wants it and can get it, is it has that double benefit. And so today, and this is not a new development, but people have become increasingly aware of it in recent years, some kind of post-secondary degree or credential is really essential to getting a good job, a job at a wage that will allow you to support yourself and your family. And it doesn't have to be a bachelor's degree at a four-year institution. It can be a much shorter term degree or certification in a field that is in high demand in the workforce. But that is the surest path to upward mobility, as it was for earlier generations. But unfortunately, higher education is much less accessible than it used to be in the United States. So there's kind of a conflict between those two things. We need it, but it's harder to get.
Right. And it's sad to see that we had some of these and then have kind of gone backwards in many ways. And now we're trying to clamber back up to where we were before. And I want to talk about that in a minute. But before we talk about that, I'd just like to know, you know, higher education was great for me. First generation going to college, and we did it big time. I come from a working class family in the Boston area. First generation to go to college, and I went to Yale, and then I went on and got a law degree, and it's just completely changed my life. It's just opened up so many doors to have that, and I would love to see more people enjoy that opportunity. So before we dive into the policy side of things, could you say just on a personal level, what has higher education meant for you personally?
Right, of course. And yes, you did go in a big way straight from first generation student straight to Yale and a law degree. Higher education was also really essential in my own family's path to upward mobility. In my case, it was my mother and my father who were first generation college goers, and they happened to be in California at a time when California's systems of higher education were effectively free, close to free. Mm-hmm. So they were both from very poor families, but they and their siblings were all able to go get bachelor's degrees and master's degrees. And that was a turning point for our family, putting us on a path to upward mobility and from poverty into the middle class. I grew up at a time when higher education, I also grew up in California, was still accessible. It wasn't free, but it was reasonable. And a solidly middle-class family, like my parents, could afford to send my brother and me to our public university system without them taking on too much debt, without our having to work too many hours to pay our tuition bills. And sadly, it's not the case anymore that an affordable public education is available to most Americans without a very high level of borrowing.
Exactly right. Well, when I say I went to law school, it was in California, and I went to the University of California Bolt Law School, which at the time was the best quality legal education for the lowest price in the country.
It is still an excellent school. I don't know if it's still the lowest priced, but it's probably cheaper than a lot of places because it's part of a public system, but not as inexpensive as it used to be.
And why is that? You know, we had California, I think, was probably leading the states with a great higher education program. They had, and not just the four-year college, you know, the law school, it's the community colleges. They just all the way up the ladder had an excellent public post-secondary education. And then it all fell to pieces. And why would we go to all the trouble of having that to see that it works both for individuals and for our communities, for our economy, for our country, and then dismantle it? What happened?
I don't think anyone set out to dismantle California's excellent, affordable higher ed system, but you're absolutely right. It did fall apart, and you can date it back to the 1970s. In California, there were already some trends underway that were problematic for the continuation of affordable higher education, which is that the state was growing so fast and college degrees and credentials were becoming increasingly valuable and more people wanted them. The state had made a commitment to keeping its systems of higher education affordable, and they couldn't carry through on that commitment. It had to be paid for by the state. And of course, what that meant is it needed to be paid for by tax revenues. And in the 1970s, you had the very well-known Prop 13, Proposition 13, the Taxpayers' Revolt, where California property owners basically passed a proposition that radically cut property taxes. And of course, that decline in revenue had to come out of something, and it came out of California's educational system. So that was the beginning of real challenges to affordability throughout all of California's systems. The community college system, for a variety of reasons, is still highly affordable and in many cases free, but the University of California and the California state systems are very expensive. And California is just an example. It probably had the most extensive and long-lasting free college experiment, if you'd like to call it an experiment. It went on for a century. But in other states, public flagship institutions, public regional universities were also very affordable. And that affordability foundered mainly on declining public support for higher ed, declining state willingness to pay for it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's sad to see it kind of go down like that. But when it did go down, when the states, and in New York City also had a great program accessible to virtually everybody, and then it kind of foundered also in the 1970s, which you write about in the book. But once those public programs were cut back or in some cases ended, the inevitable happened, and the burden of education fell on the shoulders of the individual students, who either you end up with students with these massive debts, you know, crushing burden. I mean, really, $1.6 trillion being carried by students who are just trying to do the American dream, get an education, get a job, get ahead. Or even worse, people cut out entirely who said, I can't afford it, and just never went to college, and therefore led lives that were much more diminished than they might have been had they had the opportunity for a good education. So it really, that defunding of a program, as you say, in California worked for 100 years. We knew it worked, and then still kind of dismantled some of it. it just led to this crushing student debt. Would you say that's a fair representation of what happened?
I think it is. And to just be very blunt about it, when states pay for things, they are not paying for them out of their pockets. They're paying for them with tax revenue. So it was a societal consensus that people were willing to pay taxes to support these high quality educational systems because the state and the nation benefited from them. California's mm-hmm. rapid industrialization and leading edge in key industries and booming economy was very closely related to the availability of high quality, close to free higher education. And increasingly, I mean, we have been obsessed in this country for 40 years now with no tax increases without a very clear discussion of the fact that you pay taxes for things and you as a society agree that certain things are worth paying for. And I don't think we ever have that conversation very bluntly. The other thing I should add related to what you just said is that the whole issue around what college costs is very mystifying if you don't have a lot of experience with college. You'll see these private colleges with these astronomical, what we call sticker prices, because almost nobody pays them. I saw a report that just came out yesterday that said 53% of students attending private, independent, not-for-profit colleges, your small liberal arts colleges, including colleges like Yale, have their tuition discounted. So mm-hmm. those high sticker prices are not always paid. People who don't have a firsthand or family experience with college really don't know what it costs. We've done some surveying here of students, and you know, you'll hear everything from a few thousand dollars to $100,000 to go to college. And so I think there's a lot of demystification that could go on. It's also very difficult to access federal financial aid, and the whole admission application financial aid process is laborious and confusing. And if you're not familiar with it, if you're a first generation student or a low income student, it is very hard to navigate on your own.
Right, exactly. You know, the young people coming up need support, particularly first generation ones. I mean, honestly, I had never heard of Yale. I grew up in a suburb north of Boston, and the college we all knew was Harvard. It's like, really? There's another college?
Another one.
So, but my sister also went to college, and I found out about Yale through her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. That often happens. These very idiosyncratic networks of you mm-hmm. have a friend whose parent knew something or whose sibling or your cousin does something. And those networks are incredibly valuable in helping you navigate to college. But really, we can do better than that. Seeming
yeah, we should be a little more systematic about it.
Right.
I mean, I think about all that talent, all that genius, all those smarts with a little bit more education, then they could be these students with that education, help us with climate change, figure that out, and help us with all the other issues, the pandemic, the health issues in the country. We need the talent of everybody in this country as developed and educated as we can. So I am a huge fan of your book. And for those who are watching on the YouTube, here's the book. It's called The Path to Free College. And you definitely want to get a copy to understand what happened and how we had this in the 20th century, higher education, we lost it. And worse now, but because the need is so strong, it's coming back again. Mm-hmm. And we're needing to reinvent it mm-hmm. again. And fortunately, given that we're Americans, we can do that. So I was very excited to see in your book to learn about the response now, because the crushing student debt, because the lack of equity, the people now being cut out totally, particularly Black people, people of color, low income, the whole set of people who just like frozen out unless you've got the money and connections to get into these higher education system. That people are recognizing we actually need access to this higher education. And like you said, not everybody's going to go to 4-year. It could be 2-year. It could be community college, could be a certificate program. learn how to use the health machines or, you know, whatever it is, but just that extra training and education that makes you more marketable, makes you able to earn more money, and helps your local economy and helps the country. So it's a great idea. And I was excited to see what you talk about, the reemergence of affordable public education. Can you talk a little bit about, like, where did that start? Like, where is this new? I see it as a renaissance in accessible public education. Where would you say that renaissance began and why?
Right. And I think the term you use, reinvention, is a great idea. And you're right. Americans are really good at that. When we have a problem, we'll come up with a solution, but it may not be available to everybody in an equitable way. I trace in the book and in my research the emergence of these tuition-free college programs, which are sometimes called promise programs, although that's a very loose term that includes a lot of things, to the program in the community where I live in Kalamazoo, Michigan, something called the Kalamazoo Promise, which was announced in 2005. And there were many other efforts that took individual cohorts of students and paid their college tuition, or some community colleges that were tuition free. But the Kalamazoo Promise was very interesting in that it was the first of this wave of programs to clearly articulate this idea that we can help our community by sending a whole bunch of our young people to college tuition free. We can rebuild our school district. We can attach people more securely to the community. We can attract home buyers and maybe businesses. We can keep people here. And so it was, and at the same time, we can help open up this opportunity for low-income students to build their human capital and not to have that situation you describe where people are not really able to reach their full potential because of a lack of education and training. So the Kalamazoo Promise was announced in November 2005. It was created by a local group of donors who have opted to remain anonymous. And here, 15 and a half years later, they're still anonymous, but which is a good trick in this day and age. But they have paid for graduates of the Kalamazoo Public Schools, which is an urban high poverty school district in our mid-sized city. For those of you who don't know where we are, we're exactly halfway between Detroit and Chicago in West Michigan, to go to college. And students coming out of Kalamazoo Public Schools can choose one of 59 institutions in state, ranging from community colleges to some vocational or vocational training programs to our flagship public institutions, as well as a group of private colleges. And one of the things that is really wonderful about the program for our community is that it's set up to continue in perpetuity. It's not a short-term fix for our problems, which is a good thing because sending people to college is not a short-term fix. Mm-hmm. It's a long-term investment strategy. It's important to think of it that way. But what happened, and this is not something I've heard that the donors really even thought about happening, is that many communities around the country looked at this and said, this is an awesome idea. We should try it here. So now we have about 200 communities and community colleges around the nation in every kind of community that offer a tuition-free path to college to at least a large portion of their high school graduates, and sometimes to adults as well. And we've also seen this essential, what we sometimes call a place-based scholarship model. You get the scholarship based on where you go to school and where you live. We've seen that in a number of states as well.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me. If you had said to me in 2004, where is the renaissance for public education going to come from? I assure you, Kalamazoo would not be in my first 500 places I would mention.
Yeah, I don't think it would have been on anybody's list. So it's a great example of local innovation and these ideas that come up from the grassroots to respond to local needs, and then they spread around.
Exactly. And I love that. And by the way, I've written a whole book on kind of the best of what's working in the United States, with the idea that we can adapt and adopt these successful problems, that we've solved every problem somewhere. Someone has done it.
Right.
And the key is to adapt and adopt those successful models in a bigger way. Absolutely. And that's exactly what Americans have done here, led by Kalamazoo. Thank you, Kalamazoo. Mm-hmm. And did you find, I didn't see this address, so I'm just curious. Did people move from other places to go to Kalamazoo so they have access to this free tuition?
Yes, it's quite interesting because in the first year after the Kalamazoo Promise was announced, there was a big increase in the size of the school district. It had been declining like most school districts in our neck of the woods, in most of the country and in most urban settings. The district had been declining in terms of enrollment for 20, 30 years. In that first year after the Promise was introduced, the school district enrollment went up by 10%. And about half those students, about 1,000 people came, maybe not quite 1,000, came from outside the area. Some people came from other states, some people came from other parts of Michigan. But the school district has continued to grow. It's about 25% larger than it was when the Promise was announced. But the growth is not coming so much from people moving into the community. It's growing because people are not leaving. And they're not leaving the school district. So we've seen what my colleagues who study these things call a decline in exit rates. Mm-hmm. Normally people flowed out of this urban high poverty school district at regular intervals, and now they're not. I mean, a few are, but much less so. So the district is growing because people are coming in kindergarten and all along the way, and they're not leaving. And I think that's exactly, I mean, I haven't had a chance to ask them because of this little anonymity thing, but I think that's exactly what the donors had in mind. I don't think they were trying to get everyone to pick up and move to Kalamazoo, although it is a very wonderful place, but they were trying to make the community more attractive for people who already live here.
Right, it stops the brain drain.
Right.
Then you get this, otherwise the smart young ones all take off as soon as they're out of high school, go somewhere else. So that's really good to hear. And of course, now that we've got 200 communities offering some variation of this promise of the free education, or, you know, it's popping up in so many different places. It's really kind of incredible. And the other thing that struck me about this whole renaissance happening was that it's not a centralized group saying, hey, this is a great idea, let's do this all over the country. That in fact, it's very much bottom up, this is what we wanna do here. And so talk a little bit about that, like how the diffusion of the idea of this free or low cost public education happened.
Yes, I'm glad to, because that's such a fascinating feature of this movement. It has no central leadership or central control. It is simply a process of replicating or emulating what's being done elsewhere, and it's local stakeholders that are doing it. So it's quite interesting. We do have a very loose network. We've had these 10 conferences, almost annual conferences, called PromiseNet, where people come together and kind of share best practices and what they've learned about operating these kinds of programs. But that program, that conference emerged because all these, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, all these communities kept traveling to Kalamazoo and saying, oh, we'd like to try to do this in our community. What can we learn from you? So a few people said, let's get everyone together at the same time. And periodically, this group has contemplated this question of, should we have a central organization, a keeper of the promise label? And the answer has always been no, because the people who are engaged with this work are very much focused on their local communities. And these programs look different in every place, depending on the resources, the assets that community has, and what its needs are. And so it is a very heterogeneous, diverse grassroots movement. Even though it has spread kind of on its own power. What's very interesting is there was a program in Knoxville, Tennessee, that was inspired in part by the Kalamazoo Promise, and it was called Knox Achieves. And then that program grew and grew and ultimately became the seed of a statewide program in Tennessee called the Tennessee Promise, which in turn has become a model for other states. So there are between 15 and 20 states that have set up some kind of tuition-free college for residents, they all, again, look different. But Tennessee is one of the leaders in this space, which is not where you would necessarily expect the leadership to come from. It's a very conservative state. It's Republican-led. And yet it is the leader at the state level in this free college movement.
Yeah, that's very impressive. And I love that sense of adaptation and people figuring out what they need at the local level and shaping it that way. When I started this, it took me about 20 years going around the United States looking at the best of what's working in different areas. My original thought was, oh, well, we'll find someone who's created a great model and then we can just bring it to other places and you don't have to reinvent the wheel. And the one who really taught me how to think about that in a more organic way was Deborah Meyer, who is a MacArthur Genius Award winner in education for her work in Central Park East, where she got people from all kinds of families, low income, et cetera. And 90% of the students graduated and 90% of them went to college and the others were off with careers in music or art or something else. But she said, Eleanor, it's not a good idea to take something that's been created and then like force people into that. Right. You can take the principles that underlie that program and that approach and then adapt them in different settings and it will be constantly changing. And that's why I started using the phrase adapt and adopt the breakthrough solutions and the different approaches. And that's exactly what's happened here with this, you know, label of the promise, but it's got so many different variations. And I love that it's Kalamazoo is the first community that did it. And that Tennessee is the first statewide program. And you talk in Tennessee about the fact that it's a Republican controlled state politically, but the business leaders understood they needed trained workers. And I found it fascinating. It's a little bit buried in your book, but when you talked about the business leaders in Tennessee, when they were thinking about moving and maybe moving operations to Tennessee, they were less interested in what's the tax break that the state's going to give me? They were more interested in, can you assure us of an educated workforce that will be able to do the jobs well? And I think that's an area where a lot of cities and states fall down. They bend over backwards trying to give these great economic benefits and low cost and tax breaks to the companies. But really, the key is this high quality, educated workforce. So I'm really excited about that Tennessee model and that it's bipartisan.
Yeah, I have to jump in here and say I have some very, very talented colleagues here at the Upjohn Institute. And one of them, I co-direct with two of my colleagues, an initiative around what communities can do to create broadly shared prosperity. And my colleague Tim Bardick has written extensively on economic development incentives of the type that you're mentioning, tax breaks and all of that. They are highly inefficient, extremely expensive. They rarely do what they say they're going to do. And as you just said, the very best incentive you can offer a business seeking to expand its operations or locate is a high quality, productive workforce. That is the single most important asset for a business being successful. And yet we invest a huge amount of money in these economic development incentives that almost never pay off. So yeah, they create a lot of excitement at the time they're granted and some nice ribbon cutting opportunities, but they aren't really doing what they promise to do in terms of creating more good jobs.
Exactly right. And I've seen this in my home state of Massachusetts. You know, we're a very big manufacturing area for many decades and with the textiles and the shoes and everything else coming out of the whole New England area, really. But there was a big decline in those as companies were moving to underdeveloped countries, moving offshore to outside the United States for the cheaper labor. And there was kind of this sense of like a dying economy, but what Massachusetts has is incredible education. Just in the greater Boston area, we have 50 colleges and universities alone, including Harvard and MIT. So all that brain power, all that trained people, then companies came looking for that for biotech and work in the health industry and kind of the computer and technology. They want the educated workforce. So I was so glad that you talk about that in your book. So we're seeing now this renaissance with communities, with the states in some cases, Tennessee. What about nationally? Like now we've got this patchwork,
right?
And they're very different based on the local flavor and needs. What are the prospects of having a national program? Or maybe it's not a good idea to have one, given that we've got this grassroots coming up. I mean, what do you think about a national free college program?
Right. There are really clear trade-offs of the kind that you mentioned. When your programs are rooted locally, they are responsive to what the local economy or what the state economy needs. And it's much harder to do that at the national scale. Yet at the same time, there's tremendous inequality. If you happen to go to school in Kalamazoo or in Tennessee, you have affordable higher ed opportunities available to you that if you're in a neighboring city or state, you don't have. So there's also tremendous that patchwork nature, which is a word I use a lot to describe what we have, is very inequitable. And it just has to do with sort of accident of geography. So national initiatives have the potential to really create more equality of opportunity than these more locally based programs. Yet you need to be kind of careful so you still preserve that ability to tailor a program to local needs. Different states, different regions, different communities need different kinds of workers. They have business, they have labor markets that look different. So there has to be some flexibility embedded in any national program. The program that the Biden administration has proposed, this was proposed in the American Families Plan that was announced at the end of April, is a federal state partnership where the federal government will be paying most of the money, but states need to buy in with some commitments and some financial support, and hopefully we'll be able to retain some measure of influence over what their tuition-free college program looks like. It is confined to the two-year community college sector, but there are a lot of options within that sector for both higher achieving and lower achieving, but maybe first generation or more technically oriented students who want to go more in the direction of a certification than maybe go on to a four-year institution. But it's a fine line to walk to preserve that balance of a national program that is still responsive to local and state needs.
Yeah, so I'm curious about this. I was a little surprised in the book. I don't think I saw the word apprenticeship anywhere in there. And my husband works in the public transit sector all across the country, trying to get young people into transit jobs and training the current workforce in safety and new technology. And when I was talking to him about your book and how significant I think your book is and the movement for greater access to education, I said, you know, it's so sad that so many young people are locked out because of the cost. And he said, well, there's an answer to that. And that is apprenticeship is the one place where you go and you actually get paid while you learn. So if you want to apprentice as a carpenter or a plumber or electrician, you're actually earning money while you're learning the skill. Have you addressed apprenticeship at all in these programs?
Yeah, I mean, that is a really great observation. And I think what it has to do with is it relates to the way our systems are separated in silos. Apprenticeships are not part of the formal higher ed system in most states. Mm-hmm. There are community colleges that offer all kinds of vocational and technical training, but apprenticeships are paid for by employers. And they are usually part of the state's workforce system, and they're often receive federal funding or state funding, but they sit kind of separately on a separate track from higher ed. And that's problematic. I mean, we have that problem in lots of different sectors in the US because really an integrated system of post-secondary education and training should provide students with a buffet of options, including apprenticeships, voc ed at a community college, four-year degrees, certifications, and yet the apprenticeships sort of sit to the side. And that's why I think those of us who work on these free college programs really wish there were a way from a system standpoint to really include apprenticeships, but it's just hard because of the way they're funded and the way they're structured. They are certainly an amazing option. And they, again, are an example of different communities have different apprenticeships. We have our workforce development agency called Michigan Works. We have a road construction apprenticeship. We have an early childhood education apprenticeship. We have some manufacturing apprenticeships. That's what our local economy needs. In a different place, the workforce development agency is going to know that different kinds of workers are needed and create some different apprenticeship pathways. So that's good. I mean, that's the way it should be. But that's why we don't talk a lot about apprenticeships when we talk and do research on free college. But it should be included.
Yeah, well, maybe we can work towards that.
Yeah.
But first, let's get higher ed as it is, more equal and more accessible all across the country. So tell us a little bit about this American Families Plan. Yeah. That Biden proposed, and I know you advised his campaign. You're advising some of his policy people now. You know, you're saying it's a 2-year, mostly focused on 2-year. Is that going to, if that were passed, what would that do? That would make everybody in the country more on a level playing field. Everybody could get 2 years beyond high school for some kind of training or education of their choice.
It could, but it's going to depend. Well, first, it will depend on passage
right.
of legislation, and then it will depend on state decisions to participate. The federal government would be putting a lot of money on the table, so there would be strong incentives for states to buy into the program, but not all states would. And we saw that, we certainly saw that with Medicaid expansion. Right. There was a lot of money on the table. From a rational standpoint, it made sense to expand your Medicaid eligibility, claim those resources, but many states opted not to. And it's everything in our, it's sad because everything in our nation seems to have become politicized, whereas the free college movement for most of its history was either very nonpartisan, as in these local community programs, or bipartisan, as in the Tennessee program and other states as well. We've had an adult tuition-free college program passed in Michigan and funded by a Republican legislature that doesn't agree with almost anything that our Democratic governor proposes. But on this, they could agree. And the role of the business community was really important here. Michigan is way behind in terms of generating college grads with degrees and credentials that are needed for our state's economic competitiveness. The plan that President Biden proposed, and I should be clear, I was part of a large education policy committee, advisory committee during the campaign. Any influence I have over the administration now is purely informal, but I am really happy that the policymakers that are in higher ed in the Biden administration know about this free college research and they know about best practices. And I think that's been a problem in the Promise movement, where ideas piloted in one place, everyone reinvents the wheel. They don't know what the collective knowledge is about the field. But the policymakers in the Department of Higher Ed do, in the Department of Education now do, and also in the proposed head of the Commerce Department, Gina Raimondo, Secretary of Commerce Secretary, is coming from her role as governor of Rhode Island, where she was very involved in starting a statewide Rhode Island Promise, a free college program there. So there's expertise in various parts of the administration, including in the president's residence itself with Dr. Jill Biden and her history. The Biden administration and Joe Biden and Dr. Jill Biden have had a long commitment to community colleges as a kind of a neglected national resource. During the presidential campaign, the Biden administration was on record as supporting two different free college programs, one very much similar to what was introduced at the end of April. The other was a more expansive, it looked more like what Senator Sanders had proposed, a tuition-free path to 4-year public universities with an income cap, a family income cap of $125,000 a year. So very affluent people would not have access to this. But the administration has gone ahead pursuing that more modest cost program as part of the American Families Plan, which is kind of part two of the infrastructure plan, the American Jobs Plan, for the recovery of the U.S. economy. And they take a very broad view of what it will take for the U.S. to really recover. It will require investment, not just in physical infrastructure, but also social infrastructure and education systems. So the higher ed piece of that American Families Plan has a chunk of money for tuition-free community college for everyone in states that buy into the plan. It also has a meaningful expansion in Pell Grants, which are the chief form of federal financial aid grants to low-income students. It offers 2 years of tuition coverage at minority-serving institutions, like historically Black colleges and universities. It also provides money to community colleges to develop various kinds of high-impact support strategies that will help students be successful once they get to community college. So there's some really good things in the plan. What was interesting to me, it was very much in line, and of course I wrote this book well before the Biden administration took office. It's very much in line with what I wound up coming down at as a politically viable plan. Mm-hmm. So I was happy to see that. But what was interesting to me is that the Biden administration paired this 2 years of post-secondary education and training with 1 to 2 years of high-quality pre-K. And the argument is very simple. The argument is that we have an education system now that was created for last century, early last century. It's maybe 100 years out of date. And whereas 12 or 13 years of education might have been enough for the mid 20th century economy, it's clearly not enough for success in the 21st century economy. So we need to be thinking more in terms of 16 or 17 years of education as expected and free or affordable.
Right, exactly. It sounds like a fantastic plan, this American Families Plan. And what's not to love? And what are the odds of it passing? It's part of this giant, like $4 trillion two bills that need to be passed.
Right. And I don't think they're going to get passed in the form of two giant bills. I think pieces will be pulled out and introduced. There are three pieces of free college legislation currently working their way through various parts of Congress. And one of them, the bill that Senator Patty Murray sponsored, is basically this plan. So I think... I don't know. The critical question for me is whether the business community at the national level will behave the same way and pursue the same priorities that it did in Tennessee, that it did in Michigan, because business enthusiasm for this tuition-free college plan focused on community colleges that quickly generate degrees and credentials that are of value in the workforce and of value to employers and help the economy. Business support was critical. It was critical for bringing on board Republican legislative support for these bills. And I don't know if that's going to operate the same way at the national level. I do know there's been a fair amount of polling done on this question of whether a couple of years of post-secondary ed should be tuition-free. And there are high levels of support that span Republicans, Democrats, and independents for making more education tuition-free. It is an issue that resonates with people regardless of their politics. Everyone knows that it is very unaffordable these days to go on to college.
Yeah, that's encouraging. And it seems to me that there would be bipartisan support, but then I think that about so many things that seem commonsensical. But the Republicans just seem hell-bent on preventing Biden or the Democrats from having any victories. And you talk very honestly, and I think with good political judgment in the book, that this was bipartisan. The Kalamazoo, Tennessee were Republican-backed. Bipartisan, but then with Bernie Sanders coming out big time for it. And then Elizabeth Warren, it became like everybody in the 2020 Democratic presidential campaign had some version of free college or how to deal with the tuition thing. So it kind of gave it more of a Democratic tinge. Yes. So if it happens now, the Republicans are going to say, oh, well, that'll be a big win for the Democrats, as opposed to, hey, that actually helps the people of America.
Well, I think what the Biden administration did very carefully and consciously is they went with the free college plan, the version of tuition-free college that has the potential to draw bipartisan support. Mm-hmm. And they have a narrow path to walk because, of course, there's opposition on the right to spending money on any kind of economic and social investment, even things like wiring the nation for broadband, which we obviously desperately need. But there's also some opposition on the left from people who wanted a more expansive version of free college that would cover the four-year sector. So it's a very narrow path, but they chose a sector and a program that I believe has the potential to draw bipartisan support. I mean, I'm worried because the strategy of Republicans in Congress is starting to look more and more like the strategy during the Obama administration, which is, just say no to mm-hmm. everything. The Biden folks are quite familiar with that. So mm-hmm. they have really come up with ways. And of course, there's that very, very narrow Senate and House margin in favor of the Democrats for now. So they are not going to spend a lot of time spinning wheels on bipartisanship. They are going to try to get bills passed into law while they can, but they're going to have to be bills that can basically draw support from all of the Democrats in Congress because the prospects for bipartisanship, sadly, look worse every day.
Well, I love the press secretary in the White House when she was asked about reaching out to Republicans. And she said, we're moving ahead to help the American people. We welcome any Republicans who want to join us.
They're going to move quickly. The sense is the Obama administration kind of got bogged down pursuing bipartisanship, and the Biden administration is not making that mistake. And they're viewing bipartisan support as public support. So if states and business organizations and large segments of the American public are supportive of policies, they're going to take that as the sign to move ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and there is, if we can't get the two-year plan, which I love, the two-year plan plus the Pell Grants joined with whatever the states can do, the simplest pare-down that you mentioned in the book as an alternative would be increased funding for Pell Grants, because we've already got a system of distribution. It's helping. It's a kind of a targeted way to help people who need it most. What do you think about that as kind of a fallback?
Well, I think about it as a really good thing to do. Pell Grants have utterly failed to keep up with the increase in the cost of college. Back in the 70s, the average Pell Grant would cover 3/4 of the full cost of tuition at a four-year public institution. And now that's down to about 1/4. Pell Grants have never been indexed for inflation. They've never kept up with the rising price of college, which has been incredibly rapid. But Pell Grants are politically very, very popular. As Congress well knows, money through the Pell program goes into every congressional district in the US, lots of money, and many constituents rely on it. So it does have some political traction. Increasing the value of Pell Grants would be very helpful to Pell eligible students. There are two problems. One is that a lot of students who would qualify for Pell Grants don't know that they qualify for Pell Grants and don't apply for them, so they never receive them. And the other problem is that people whose incomes are just above the Pell cutoff really struggle managing college costs. They don't qualify for federal aid, and yet they don't have enough money to really pay for their kids to go to college. So expanding Pell Grants would not help that population. One of the promising things that we've learned in Tennessee is with the Tennessee Promise, which offers this very simple message of you can go to college tuition-free, community college, Everyone applies for Pell now. Everyone files their FAFSA in Tennessee. They have the highest statewide FAFSA filing rate in the nation, because now it's not something that you tell students to do when they're seniors in case they want to go to college. It's just a step in this process of accessing the Tennessee Promise. So that word free has a lot of power, even if you're not necessarily bringing a lot of new resources to students. You're changing the conversation, and you get an increase in the uptake of Pell Grants and the application process for those grants. So I don't think doubling Pell is, I think it's a great idea, and I think it's possible politically, maybe not doubling, but certainly meaningful increases in Pell, but it's not going to address those equity and access challenges that I write about in the book.
Right, exactly. Well, it would be, you know, half a loaf and better than no loaf.
Absolutely.
Hopefully we can get something through, and I'm loving what Joe Biden is doing as president, and what an amazing first 100 years. I was on his policy team also looking on the economy and on women's issues, and was very impressed with the caliber of people involved. And, you know, they were like, tell us what needs to be done, what can be done in the first 100 days, what done after that. And they have taken all the best ideas and really run with them. And I'm just so excited about that. And I'm heartbroken that the Republicans are not reaching out to his extended hand to help the country. But
I agree. The campaign was incredibly well organized in terms of really soliciting ideas on many, many issues from many people, and really trying to find the best ideas and being very disciplined in terms of priorities. And I agree, it's been an impressive start. And we, you know, the next year is critical to see what is able to turn into law through whatever means.
Right, exactly. So one silver lining we have here is that part of what President Biden did already with his immediate relief bill with the pandemic and infusion of money to cities and state, he's really pumping out. I mean, there's a big front page story in the Washington Post today that all our regional governments are now like way ahead of where they thought they would be. They're even like a little better than they were before the pandemic. Right. The state of Virginia now has $500 million extra dollars that it didn't expect to have. Mm-hmm. And they're going, oh, what can we do with this? That he's really helped lift the country out of this pandemic depression that we were in, as well as the actual shots in arms, which has been phenomenal. But I was hopeful that maybe because of this extra money that the states are having and city, that maybe some of that money will go to this, you know, post-secondary, more training and education after high school programs.
Right. I think it very well could, and it's a very cost-effective investment. In Michigan, this program to allow everyone who is 25 and over and doesn't have a college degree to go back to community college tuition-free, it's only, the amount of money budgeted for it is $30 million, which is a trifling sum relative to the state budget. It sounds like a lot, but it really isn't. These investments, particularly if they make use of existing financial aid like Pell Grants, are really low cost and they generate high returns. And I hope that states and localities will use some of those fiscal resources to really strengthen that pathway into post-secondary education and training.
Yeah, fantastic. I hope so too. And any citizens, ask your elected officials to do it. If you're listening and you are an elected official, here's a good way to get tremendous bang for your buck. It's like investing in, it'll give payoff for decades to come and immediate good stuff happening. So it's a great way to go for the government funding. And for those who are listening, citizens and elected officials, I know it's a mammoth question here, but with over 200 of these promise programs for low-cost free education, you're like a world expert in this now, and you've written the book on it. what would you say are, you know, two or three of the best practices that if someone is listening and wants to have it in their community, what two or three programs would you point to or aspects of a program that you think should be built upon?
Yes, I'd rather point to some principles rather than some specific programs, but I would say there are three very important lessons we have learned from this 15 years of research into promise programs. One of them is that simplicity is important. No matter how complex the funding arrangements are on the back end, the face of this program that faces the public needs to be simple. I have a young friend who never finished her college degree, and I was telling her about this Michigan Reconnect program, and she filled out the application on her phone and it took 5 minutes. And to me, that's a best practice, right? Mm-hmm. Someone's gonna give you money to go back to college and it's only gonna take you 5 minutes to fill out that application and you can do it on your phone. Tennessee has been really, really good on this front, and Michigan and other states have learned from Tennessee. So simplicity matters, and you need to resist the temptation to lay a bunch of requirements on top of your free college program, which sadly Virginia, which has proposed a free college program, has done. You can only get it if you're majoring in certain fields, and then other states have required certain high school GPA or attendance requirements. You have to resist that temptation, as tempting as it is. The second key lesson is that you can't expect to generate usable degrees and credentials if you're sending a bunch of new folks to community colleges and not supporting them once they get there. So students, whether they're adult returning learners or high school students, they need help and support navigating their way to a right fit post-secondary program, and they need support when they're there. It's not rocket science. It usually involves various kinds of coaching programs and the use of data to push services out to students, but it does cost money, and that often gets neglected in favor of talking about the tuition subsidy. And the last thing I would say, which harks back to your very opening comments, is that I really recommend that communities think broadly about making these programs universal, available to everyone, rather than trying to narrowly target them. Everyone has the potential to realize their utmost human capital. And so investing in everyone, not requiring them to do the same thing, but to do something, is going to pay off both for them and for society.
I think that's great. And that's part of why we've had Social Security as such tremendous support. It's a universal program. If you start targeting it just to poor people, it makes it easier to shrink it and then kill it.
Absolutely.
So, and I love this universal, like government should be helping people be their best people, learn and develop their skills and talent, contribute and make the next generation even better. So I so appreciate the fabulous work you've done, and I hope to have you back sometime. But for right now, that's all the time we have. Michelle Miller Adams, thank you so much for being on the show today and for your fabulous book, The Path to Free College.
Thank you so much, Eleanor. I've really enjoyed the conversation.